Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to the Women's World Cup show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and sports journalist Ella German. And Ella, it is finally launch day. We have liftoff on the Women's World Cup France 2019. In just under an hour, we'll be kicked off in the first game of the tournament. It hosts France against South Korea. An exciting one to start.
Yeah, absolutely. France, the hosts, going into this full of confidence, especially not only it being on home soil, but also having the men's victory behind them last year means that they could become the first nation to hold the men's and women's World Cup titles at the same time if all goes to plan this year. This evening, I can't see past a France win, to be honest.
I think comfortable France win?
I think so. I think if you line up the two sides, we've seen the lineups come out earlier. You see France's starting 11 is full of, it's a Lyon all-star team really. And for those who perhaps don't know, Lyon are just the dominant force in not only French women's football, but European. I think they've won the Champions League for a fourth successive year or something
Hegeberg,
like that.
Hegerberg, Marijan, Le Sommer.
That's it. And in the French team, we've got players like Wendy Renard at the back. We've got Amandine Henry on midfield. And we've also got the likes of Le Sommer up front, who is an absolute goal machine. I think it's 73 goals in 150 appearances for her country. And, you know, a 20-plus goal scorer for Lyon every season. So I really can't see beyond the France win, to be honest. But you have to touch on South Korea a little bit. They have got some decent players, the likes of Chelsea's Ji So-yeon. Claire Rafferty actually said on the Offside Rule podcast earlier this week that she considers her to be the best player in the world, which I don't think I agree with. But again, Claire Rafferty's played with her and a lot of the best players in the world, and I certainly haven't, so perhaps
no, but that doesn't mean you don't get an opinion. It really frustrates me when you get former footballers go, well, no, but you haven't played the game, you don't understand. You think, well, yeah, I haven't written any novels either, but I can still decide that a book's not very good. If she's not the best in the world, who for your money is, Ella, and is she playing at this tournament?
No, she's not. I'm gonna have to go with Ada Hegerberg. Like, I think obviously the Ballon d'Or winner this year, which was overshadowed by the comments, but let's ignore that and look at what a great player she is. I think you've only got to type her name into YouTube and see her reel, her goals, her skills, and she's going to be a massive loss at this tournament for sure. I think she is definitely who I consider to be the best player in the world, but there are a lot of contenders out there. You know, I'm sure we'll touch on it later in the show. The likes of Le Sommer for France, the likes of Sam Kerr, all those big goal scorers are certainly a big contest for that title.
Hegerberg's absence from that Norway team is obviously because she feels that the sport isn't taken seriously enough, the women's game in her native country. Do you think that this tournament in Norway, in England and across the world can play a significant part in pushing its profile forward?
Yeah, I think this tournament is going to be the biggest and best yet. I think this could finally be the tipping point for women's football. You can see it happening already. Every time I log into Twitter, there's so many new articles, so many new podcasts coming out covering the women's game. I almost can't keep up. I log in every morning and think, oh, I want to read this. I want to listen to this. This is fantastic. But I'm just really hoping that the rest of the country, not only in England, but across Europe, worldwide, can hopefully get behind it and give it the recognition and attention it deserves.
From an English perspective, of course, a good run in the tournament will go a long way to adding to that exposure. England, of course, kick off their campaign on Sunday against Scotland. We'll be previewing that game in serious depth in just a moment's time with John Skilbeck of Omnisports. But we've got an incredible roster of opening fixtures for various clubs across the groups, clubs, nations. It'd be quite tricky. Imagine if Lyon turned up in a World Cup. Which others stand out to you?
I think tomorrow we need to be looking at Germany, China. Germany are who I consider to be amongst one of the five teams who could go and win this tournament, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about them. They're one of those, I wouldn't call them a dark horse because we all know what a strong footballing nation they are. They won back-to-back World Cups in the women's game in 2003 and 2007, but there hasn't been that many people tipping them as winners, so I'd say they're sort of a quietly confident side going into this World Cup.
they're coming off the back of a not particularly successful period at major tournaments. That can go one of two ways for a side. Either, particularly when you're a big footballing nation, as you point out, either there's immense pressure because people are saying, well, get back to your best, this is where you should be. Or you can kind of benefit from not being amongst the most obvious favourites. Do you think that Germany team will be expecting themselves to go all the way?
Yeah, I think they want to prove themselves. But like you said, it can be, it's always sink or swim for the big footballing nations entering a major tournament. We saw it with the men's German side last year. I backed them to go very far. I specifically remember sitting in my uni room with Germany-Mexico on. A friend came in and said, who's going to win? I said, Germany, hands down, 3-4-0. And look what happened. They lost
Herbing the game. Lozano.
So, but I think Germany want to go out and prove themselves. They had a difficult time under Steffi Jones where they didn't have the best run of form after their Olympic gold. But now, after that transition period, they're going to want to go out there and prove themselves on the world stage again, and they certainly have the players to do so.
Yeah, serious quality there. I love watching Marijan play.
Yeah.
She's just an extraordinarily creative talent. I want to touch as well on Australia and Australia versus Italy, because I think a lot of people watching this tournament who take their knowledge of football mainly from the men's game possibly won't realise how much of a threat Australia can be.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's too easy to compare the level that clubs are in the women's game to the men's and expect them to be exactly the same. You have it in the Women's Super League. For example, I went to see Arsenal Yeovil in the top division this season. Okay, Yeovil aren't in it anymore, but so many people would say to me, oh, was that a cup game? No, it's the top division of women's football. And I go, but Yeovil, how are they in there? So it's the same on a national level. And, you know, although you wouldn't really back the men's team often in major tournaments, you certainly can with a women's team in this tournament. They've got this sort of golden generation of players coming through. Obviously, the big name of Sam Kerr. Everyone's talking about her. Back-to-back golden boots in the Australian and the American League, and an incredible record for her country. But they've also got a whole host of goal-scoring threats, the likes of Caitlin Ford, a 24-year-old, another good goal scorer coming through, backed up by Lisa Devanna up front. They've got so many people who could cause problems for the other nations at this tournament, and I think they could go a fair way. I don't think they're good enough to compete with the best, the top-ranked teams, the USAs, the Germanys, the France, the Englands, but I think they could carve out a path to the last 16 quarterfinal, perhaps.
Yeah, possibly something of a dark horse themselves. I think that point of the quality of teams not necessarily conforming to the men's game is massively important. I mean, if we look at England's group, Group D, you were pointing out to me that actually Argentina at this World Cup aren't that much of a threat. Whereas if the men's side had got them, we would all be going, oh, Argentina, very, very frightening. As a final opening fixture to highlight, I just want to take a quick look at Brazil versus Jamaica. A tale of two players, perhaps one coming towards the end of her career, one at the beginning of potentially a very exciting one. Marta of Brazil, 33 now, arguably the greatest woman of all time. And of course, for Jamaica, young Khadija Shaw. How good a tournament can she have?
She can have a fantastic tournament. I think anyone who watched a Scotland-Jamaica game last week will know exactly what she's capable of. She's got that ability to out-muscle defenders and almost bully her way through to get goals. Interestingly, she was going to be one of the few players at the tournament that aren't playing professional football, but today she signed for French side Bordeaux, and given that the tournament is being hosted in France, she's certainly going to want to make a name for herself as she visits the country.
And given that it's being televised around the world on major broadcasters, good timing from Bordeaux, because if she does go and score 5 or 6, that value is going to skyrocket. Of course, as you said, she really caught the limelight against Scotland, and coming up, hopefully they're in for another battering at the hands of England.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to the Women's World Cup show here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and sports journalist Ella German. I'm delighted to say that we're also joined on the line by John Skilbeck, who's a sports journalist for Omni Sports, covering this World Cup. Good evening, John. Thanks for joining us. England, of course, start their campaign with a game against the old enemy, Scotland. Is it going to be 3 points?
You would think it would be 3 points for England, but it's not going to be as easy as it was 2 years ago for England. I mean, I was out in Utrecht a couple of years ago where England mauled Scotland 6-0. It was a bit of an eye-opener, I think, for the Scots that day. It was a very tough experience for them, to be honest. They were fairly shell-shocked after the game. But they've come on so much since then, and England have had a difficult time since then with the Mark Sampson departure, which affected the squad quite badly for a little while. I think they found that quite tough. And this time, you know, everyone's looking to how Phil Neville will get on as Mark Sampson's replacement. And this is the acid test, and Scotland will test England seriously on Sunday.
Obviously, you said Scotland have come a long way since that 6-0 defeat at Euro 2017, and there's been the rise of the likes of Erin Cuthbert. How important is she going to be against England on Sunday?
Well, she's a class act, isn't she? And I think England obviously know that because the England's players play against them, play against the likes of Erin, against the likes of Jen Beattie and Caroline Webb each week in the WSL. So they know all about Erin Cuthbert, but it's whether they can stop her, and it's no given that they can. I think that night in Utrecht, Scotland were fairly toothless in attack, but that's not going to be the case this time. I think Steph Orton and Millie Bright, if Millie Bright partners Steph on Sunday, I think that they're really going to have to be on their mettle. I can see Scotland scoring for sure on Sunday and really troubling that England defence, because the England defence can be a little shaky at times. And I would say probably the defence, the lineup on Sunday might not have lined up together for England for quite a while due to Phil's shuffling of the squad. So it's going to be a serious test, I think, though.
Well, talking about the Neville shuffle, John, do you reckon he knows what team he's going to play?
I think he probably does, but he's certainly been given a serious consideration for a while, which is quite different, I would say, to the situation with Mark Sampson a few years back. I spoke to Mark before the 2017 European Championships, and he pretty much had his team picked for every game about a month before that tournament. And I don't think that's been the case with Phil. I think Phil's had a really good look at every player recently. In the last couple of friendlies, he's fielded most of his squad. And I don't think before those friendlies, he had his first 11 marked down. And even after the New Zealand game, I think he was given quite a lot of food for thought, really, in that game. And he may well have changed his plans since then on the back of that performance, which wasn't a good one for England. I'm sure he's got his team picked by now, but there'll have been quite a lot of soul-searching, I think, going on.
And no matter who starts for England, we know that there are so many good players in that side, players capable of being a huge threat against Scotland. But aside from Erin Cuthbert, who else is a big danger for the Scots?
Well, Kim Little's the obvious one, really. She's the player that England would have any day in their team. I think if England lack anywhere, it is in midfield, and they'd love a player of Kim Little's sort of playmaking abilities. It's been quite a while in coming, this, for Kim. She missed Euro 2017 because of quite a serious knee ligament injury. So she's going to be at the heart of that Scotland team this weekend. And she's a serious player. She was voted most valuable player in the American Professional Soccer League about 5 years ago. Beating off all challenges from, you know, the likes of Carly Lloyd and all sorts. She was their top player over in that league for a year. So she's a serious player. She's one of the top playmakers in Europe, one of the top playmakers in the world. And again, England know all about it, whether they can stop her. And I hate to repeat myself, but it's no gimme. She's a proper world-class player, and Scotland are very lucky to have her.
John, this is a massive rivalry in the men's game. Scotland really look forward to it, hoping they can beat England. England live in abject fear of losing to the Scots. Does that kind of rivalry apply in the same way in the women's game?
I think it has to apply. I mean, these players all know each other. They all want to beat each other. I don't think perhaps the rivalry has existed historically for so long, because women's football is still a fairly new thing. England and Scotland haven't been playing each other for 150 years, year after year, really, as the men's team perhaps have. So In a way, it's a moderately new rivalry, but it's going to be a rivalry where there's going to be blood and thunder challenges coming in at the weekend, because it's obviously like a local derby, isn't it? It's one really that the players will have been looking forward to ever since the draw was made. I know that for sure. There have been some serious sort of rivalry, some few taunts going around in a few dressing rooms, I'm sure, in the last few months, or quite friendly. But when they get out on the pitch on Nice on Sunday, it's going to be a hard game. The Scots are going to play a very tough game, I'm sure. And then for sure, I'm going to roll over. And yeah, it should be a cracker come Sunday.
It's going to be a tough game, and with England and Scotland in this difficult Group D, it is really important to start off on a good note, given whoever finishes second is likely to face the likes of Canada or the Netherlands. But, John, where do you see this one going?
In terms of who's going to win the group, I think England have got a decent chance of winning the group. It's a tough group. I mean, Japan are there, and we really shouldn't underestimate Japan. They're a serious international football team. I think possibly people who don't understand or don't have a deep knowledge of the women's game will look and think, oh, maybe Argentina are the big threats in this group to England. But no, I think it's clearly Japan. They're one of the world's finest teams, and a team that probably England will be jostling for first place within this group, you would expect, come the end of the group. I think they play in the final group game, so that could be, everything to play for come that game.
John, wonderful stuff. Lovely to speak to you. Thanks for your time. John Skilbeck there, who is a sports journalist for Omni Sports, covering the Women's World Cup out in Paris. Ella, we've heard his take. Who do you see winning this game? Who do you see topping the group?
I really hate to say it.
No!
But I think Scotland could take points off us on Sunday.
I'm blaming you now, if this happens.
Well, if I say that we're going to win, I'll blame us. And we don't, I'll blame myself as well. So, no, honestly, I think Scotland are a really, really strong side. John's touched on it there. The likes of Erin Cuthbert, the likes of Kim Little. They've also got the likes of Caroline Weir pulling the strings in the middle alongside Kim Little. We've got Claire Emsley, an exciting young striker, and Jane Ross, the more experienced kind of striker. And with a centre-back pairing of Rachel Corsi and Jennifer Beating, that's one of the most experienced centre-back pairings you're going to get across the tournament. So I think it'll be really tough for England. I really hope we do pull it off, because winning this group is vital for our chances progressing through the rest of the tournament. But it's going to be tough. I can't call it, but I reckon it could end up a 1-1 draw between the two sides.
Important to get off for a good start as well for England. So fingers crossed, fingers crossed. Of course, the team are coming on nicely, and the perception of the team is improving as well. I think the response from the media to this World Cup has been far more positive than we've seen in the past. There's progress being made, but we're not there yet. We're seeing some reporting which is perhaps a little bit ill-advised, some which is certainly gendered, and some which I can say with absolute certainty would not be addressed in the same way to the men's team. Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Women's World Cup show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Ella German. And Ella, we've both been excited, not just because we have a World Cup coming up, not just because the vast majority of those games and all of England will be broadcast on the BBC, but because it feels like it's being taken seriously. The media are getting involved, fans are getting involved, people are genuinely behind this team. And yet, even with completely well-meaning reports, we're seeing some people get it completely wrong. Even, I hasten to add, the BBC themselves. Published yesterday on BBC Sport, your headline is Women's World Cup, Meet the Personalities in the Scotland Squad. Are there any red flags for you there yet? Or is that's all okay?
I think that's okay to start with, yeah.
That's okay. We're interested. We like characters in the game, don't
Absolutely.
We? The fact that, Raheem Sterling, the man, is loved as well as Raheem Sterling, the player. I'm going to read you the subtitle. See if your view changes. Which member of Scotland's World Cup squad is the sassiest? Who is the doziest? Who likes to look all stunning on Instagram, and who's prone to do some sexy singing on the team bus? Would they write that about Harry Kane?
Absolutely not. I didn't know what to make of this when I immediately read it. I read, who's the sassiest? Okay, who's Adosius. Okay, you know, it's quite nice to know what that atmosphere is like behind the players. But I got to the third one, who likes to look all stunning on Instagram. What relevance does that have to these athletes? It's not Love Island. Like, they're elite athletes. You know, why are we saying this? And then the fourth one, who's prone to some sexy singing on the bus? Why do you need the word sexy in there? I read through the article, and when it explained it, it was something that Lisa Evans had done on the team bus. And I think it was more of an in-joke between the Scotland team. But that doesn't transfer rights to the BBC Sport website for, you know, national press. So, you know, you can't imagine it, say, the Scotland team, men's team, do qualify for Euro 2020. I can't imagine us talking about Andy Robertson sexy singing.
You know,
Scott McTominay looking sexy on Instagram. Like, oh, I just can't imagine that. I think I didn't know how to react at first because I thought, oh, okay, maybe, you know, who's the sassiest? That's not that bad. But when you look more into it, there is still this layer of subconscious sexism that just wouldn't happen with the men's side. And I really appreciate the efforts that media outlets are making and getting us to know the players, but it's just been done in so many better ways. If you look at the Lionesses documentary, where you really got to know a little bit of them, 90minute.com have done some really good clips on, you know, who's who in the team, who's got the smelliest socks, that kind of thing. It's quite funny, but
who looks best on Instagram?
It just lends itself to those arguments that, you know, that's how we look at female players, and I just don't think it's necessary at all.
We should stress, of course, that BBC Scotland are reporting this from a discussion with Scotland midfielder Joe Love. These phrases, lots of them are in quotation marks, they're reported speech. So likes to look stunning on Instagram, reported speech. Sexy singing, also reported speech. But you wouldn't report it in that way if it were the men. And even the word sassiest, that's not massively offensive, but sassy is consistently talked about, not in a sporting context specifically, but in a certainly professional context. It's in there with bossy, perhaps, as a word that just doesn't get used about men, ever. And you think, when we're dealing with a tournament, which is firstly doing good things for the women's sport, but more broadly becomes a question of equality quite quickly the more we talk about it, just report on them as footballers. Is this tricky?
Yeah, I think it is. Obviously, like you mentioned, it's hard. These are, you know, the BBC haven't just come up with these. It is reported speech. But I don't think we should lead on that. I think there are other ways we can get to know the personalities of this team. Obviously, there's an interview of a couple of England players, I think Leah Williamson and Ellen White, talking about, you know, what they're into other than football. Leah Williamson being a bit of a DJ, and I think that's really cool, and that's really cool to know what their interests are. But to lead it on these, exactly what you said, these terms like sassiest, these terms of looking stunning on Instagram, these sort of phrases that lend themselves to be used towards females, I think just doesn't portray the best image necessarily of them as players. And I think, yeah, we should just refrain from leading on those kind of things.
I think there's another point there as well, particularly when you talk about whether you lead with it or not, where there's the question of how much we know about these women as players, right? So I, as an English football fan, I know quite a bit about the England women's football team. I will confess to not being an expert in the Scotland women's football team beyond Erin Cuthbert. If I knew all about these players, if I knew beyond just the obvious names like Kim Little, if I knew, for example, that Joanne Love is a particular kind of player who excels in certain circumstances, then it's more acceptable to start talking to me about whether she sings on the team bus, because I already know about her as a player. But you've got to make sure that we've got all of that information first. It's not just the reporting that's been a bit dodgy, Ella. We've had some advertising go a little bit awry as well. Some just bizarre PR activities.
Yeah, so on Twitter today, I think Coca-Cola have done an utterly bizarre PR and advertising campaign, and they've got some players to do it on their behalf. Admittedly, it's not their fault. There was a tweet that went out from a Twitter user saying something along the lines of, women's football is just not good. And they got a former England player to respond to it and say, hey, if you don't think women's football is that good, then I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to offer you some free tickets to the World Cup in France.
It's not just that. They're going to fly him out.
I don't understand. Like, why would you try and reward someone that isn't a fan of the women's game, that is trying to upset the momentum of the women's game? I don't get it, when there's going to be hundreds, thousands of, You know, not just young girls, young boys, adults, fans of the women's game who had loved that opportunity. Why not reward someone who's shown real love and desire to get into the women's game rather than, you know, these social media warriors that exist that just like to pipe up and give their opinion on how much they hate it all the time? I don't get it.
And also, you're potentially incentivizing ignorance or bad behaviour. I mean, the cynic in me sees the tweet, which was, women's football is just not very good, grammatically, obviously flawed. My instinct, as I say, the cynic in me instinctively feels, well, hang on a minute, I will get on to the player in question, Farah Williams, MBE, and go, hi, Farah, I think women's football's rubbish as well. Are Coke going to play for my flights? Because why not? If we're rewarding idiocy, oh, it's just hopeless. I understand what they're trying to do. It's jumping on the back of a bandwagon, isn't it? And it is the wrong way of going about it. I'm sure Farah Williams means it in the best possible way, but Coca-Cola possibly getting it a bit wrong.
Yeah, I just don't think it was the best approach. I think, yeah, I see what they're trying to do, but I think we also need to accept that some people are just impossible to win over. There's going to be them all the time. And I think we just need to leave them alone. And they also just need to leave the women's game alone as well. If they don't like it, turn off the TV then and don't watch it. You know, there are plenty of people out there who don't like football, men and women, and you don't see them piping up about it all the time on Twitter. So, yeah, I think we just need to, if they're really not interested, try and focus on the hopefully large proportion of the population we have that do want to get involved.
And for those of us who do want to watch it, one of the best things about this tournament is that it's going to be unbelievably easy to get involved, unbelievably easy to watch it. All of England's games are on BBC One. A vast majority of other games are on BBC One, BBC Two. They're all on the iPlayer. So never has it been easier to watch women's football, and never has it been easier to engage with it positively. That's just what Tony Duggan has done. She's given a fascinating interview to The Guardian, and coming up, we'll be having a chat about the England and Barcelona strikers' comments.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to the Women's World Cup show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and the wonderful sports journalist Ella German. We're talking about Tony Duggan, who could be set for an exciting World Cup leading the line for England. She's been leading the line, of course, in Spain for Barcelona in front of some quite impressive crowds. She's given an interview where she says she believes that England's women footballers should be better paid, but shouldn't be paid as well as the men. Ella, what do you make of that?
I completely agree. They should be better paid because, quite frankly, they're not paid enough for what they're doing right now. But we have to accept that they're on a completely different journey to the men. Women's football was banned for over 50 years in this country, so how can we ever expect it to be at the same level the men's game is now? Of course, the men's game has more investment and more support behind it. That's just the way it is. But absolutely, the England players, not just the international players, but also our top division players, should be getting paid more. I think the average salary in the WSL is something like 18 or 19,000, which isn't a lot.
For context, that's a year.
Yeah.
Not a week.
Not a week.
Because in the Premier League, 18 or 19,000 a week for the men's players is basically peanuts in relative terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in comparison, I think the average salary for a female player is a couple of million. And I think these female players, they aren't calling out for Rooney-esque salaries of £300,000 a week, which, you know, I think is ridiculous. But we could come on to that another time. I could talk about that all day. But I think they just want to be able to sustain a proper living doing what they love. Even our top division players have to fund their lives on the side. For example, West Ham captain Gilly Flaherty is running her own chirotherapy business over the summer while she's not playing. And, you know, is that the best way that for them to thrive as footballers? Probably not. They should be getting more support and definitely more money for what they're doing. But it's a difficult one because it's kind of a what comes first, chicken or the egg scenario. You know, you have to show you've got fans before you can justify getting that kind of financial reward and support. But you need to pump in that kind of support before you can drive the push for fans. So, yeah, it's a really tricky one. But as I said, they're on two completely different journeys and we are gradually getting there.
We are. Duggan, of course, talking of fans, is playing her domestic football in Spain. She's playing in front of some quite impressive crowds at some very impressive stadia. She's played at the Wanda Metropolitano in front of a crowd of 60,739. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's unbelievable for a women's game. I think we haven't had anything quite like it here. I think the highest we've had is around 45,000 in the FA Cup final in recent years.
And we've had a new WSL record set recently for Arsenal, which was around the 5,000 mark.
That's right, yeah, just over 5,000 at the Amex. So, you know, we're a long way off getting those kind of attendances. And again, those 60,000 attendances aren't a regular feature in the Spanish league. There was a big push for those matches, the same as there was over in Italy when Juventus got around 39,000 for one of their matches. But, you know, this is something that I'd love to see more of in the women's game. And, you know, Tony Duggan's right that it would be great to see that in the WSL here.
In terms of the respect that the sport has in Spain, one thing that we still haven't reached in England is serious coverage in the national press on a regular basis for the WSL. England's ladies is one thing, but, you know, if Arsenal get a massive win, it's not on the front page, it's not on the back page. Whereas Duggan is saying in Spain, in the likes of Marca, if her Barca side get a big win, that is seriously reported, it's seriously engaged with, and equally, something that's massively important for her is that they get an absolute pasting if they underperform.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. We're talking about not giving the women's game undue criticism, but I think it does, if we're asking for equality, it does need to be criticised when justified. You know, I went to the FA Cup final, you know, I'm a West Ham fan, and I was gutted to see Anna Morehouse make a couple of blunders in goal. But in the commentary and the punditry, it was kind of like poor her, that was a bit unfortunate. Whereas if that was De Gea or, you know, Karius in last season,
what is he doing?
Yeah, okay, you know, the women's FA Cup final and the men's Champions League final, that's a different kettle of fish. But, you know, he was received so much criticism for what happened. So I think if we're asking for the two games to be treated equally, we do, you know, we don't need to be giving undue praise. We do need to criticise it when justified, because ultimately that will drive the players on to improve.
Another thing that Duggan touched on is not so much the numbers of supporters, but the amount of noise, the quality perhaps of that support. She's quoted as saying sometimes there are 2,000 supporters in the crowd, but it feels like 10,000. She also says that, listen, for example, FA Cup finals in England, you do sometimes see crowds of 30, 40,000, but there are a lot of kids there. There's perhaps a slightly tamer atmosphere than we see in the men's game. Do you think the women's game needs more aggression in the crowd?
I'd like to see a little bit, because I think sometimes we verge on the edge of a sort of condescending atmosphere in a way. I wasn't at the England-New Zealand game at the Amex last week, but a lot of journalists criticised the fact that every time England did something good or every time they scored, there was something over the loudspeaker that said, oh, let's hear it for the Lionesses. And it sounded a bit American-esque and a bit patronising, a bit cheesy, and I don't really like that. But at the same time, one of the best things about the women's game is how approachable it is and how a lot of kids can go along, and it's so family friendly. You know, I've been to games where the match finishes, you can walk to the front of the stands, the players are coming along, signing shirts, signing autographs, you can have a chat. I went to the Arsenal game at the Amex and got to have a great chat with Beth Mead on the side. And, you know, who can say that they've, you know, you're not going to stroll down to the pitch at Spurs' new stadium and chat to Harry Kane, are you? And they're both stars of their national teams. So as well, I think it would be a real shame to lose that, because it's one of the great perks of the women's game, and it's only going to inspire the next generation to want to be just like them, with their role models being so accessible.
The final thing, of course, that Duggan calls for is better facilities, better and more consistency of quality of pitch, better training facilities, better changing rooms, and so on. Of course, that's only going to come with money. The men's game has seen drastic escalation in terms of level of investment in recent years. Could you see billionaire owners coming into the WSL?
Not yet. I think it will take a while. I think, obviously, we've had big investment recently with the Barclays £10 million deal into the WSL. We've had the likes of Lucozade and Nike signing deals, but I think it will take us a long while to get there, to be honest. We've come a long way. It wasn't, you know, this is the first World Cup that the England women team are wearing customised female kits. Before that, they were wearing hand-me-downs for the men, big shorts that don't fit their hips, big shirts. It wasn't long ago that they were buying their own boots and paying their own travel expenses to go to training. So we've come a long, long way, but I think we're equally a long way off that billionaire investment. But you never know, with the World Cup happening now and we're hosting the Euros in 2021, that could be an incentive for people with those kind of money to get involved.
And as a final point on the Barcelona player, let's talk about Toni Duggan, the striker. How do you rate her? How important can she be for England this summer?
She's got so much potential. We've seen that. She's a big game player. She scores goals when they're needed. But the difficulty is, as it is with a lot of the England players, where she fits in our starting 11. Phil Neville's been playing her out on the wing, and that's not where I see her. She's a striker, but you're competing with the likes of Ellen White for that position. You've also got up front the likes of Nikita Paris, Beth Mead, all competing for that front line, and they're all standout players at their respective clubs and could do really well. So I rate Toni Duggan, as I said, big game player, scores goals when she's needed, but I don't know exactly where she's going to fit. Again, we touched on it earlier. No one knows what Phil Neville's going to do. I really don't know if she's going to be part of the plans. Personally, my front three would be Beth Mead, Ellen White and Nikita Paris, all based on their form in the WSL, but you never know. I don't want to see Toni Duggan on a wing. I'd want to see her as a starting number nine, but I don't know if that will happen.
Interesting. Coming up, I think we'll have to get Ella's full starting lineup for that Scotland game. And also, ticketing issues. Why are there so many problems? We'll be getting our teeth into that. And also, who are the potential breakthrough stars of this tournament? Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
The amount of logistics and planning that goes into a major sporting tournament is extraordinary, but there's still no excuse for getting it wrong. We see the men's World Cups go off without a hitch. Ella, can the same be said for the women's tournament?
No, there's been so many problems. It all came to fruition a couple of weeks ago when people realised as their tickets for the World Cup were arriving that the people they'd booked with weren't sitting in the same place as them, which is an absolute farce. How can that happen? It's bizarre.
And that's annoying if you're, you know, a group of 5, 20-somethings going to the World Cup. It's seriously annoying. But we're hearing accounts of people who are going with their 9-year-old daughter and their 10-year-old son. And at that point, it's not just annoying, it's potentially really unsafe.
Exactly. And what I mentioned just there was that the best thing about women's football is how family friendly it is, and you know, football and World Cups in general. You paid all that money to go out to France, no matter where you've come from. But you could be coming from here, you could be coming from the States with your children for, you know, the holiday of the year to come and see the Women's World Cup. And the last thing you want is leaving your children on their own and the stand the other side at the Parc des Princes. Like, as you said, that is really dangerous, and that's terrifying for a young person in a crowd of 50,000 people to be on their own. So I can't believe they've got that wrong in the amount of preparation that should go into a World Cup. I don't understand how it's happened.
Honest mistake or negligence that you wouldn't get at a men's tournament?
The organisation should have been so much better, and it's exactly what you said. Every time something like this happens, you just ask yourself, would this happen in the men's game? I haven't heard of any instances of it before. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It seems bizarre. I mean, don't get me wrong. The organising bodies aren't going to be going, oh, it's the Women's World Cup, we don't care. The 9-year-olds can sit on their own. But if you're taking it really, really seriously and you're making sure that everything goes off with a hitch, this isn't a small error.
Yeah, you'd think those glitches would be ironed out, but apparently not, which I hope everyone's got it sorted. I don't know. I haven't got tickets myself. But I really hope that isn't the case, that someone's split up from their kids to see the match.
It's really not what you want. Talking of things you don't want, we've got the opening ceremony on the screen in front of us. There are a lot of men in tight white clothing breakdancing, which is not something I expected to see this evening. That's just my producers. The opening ceremony is actually a lot more civilised. And now, topically, lots of children there. Perhaps these are just all the kids who haven't been able to sit with their parents. Who knows? Talking of ironing out kinks, Phil Neville's looking to get the perfect 11 for Scotland. Now, we know he's been tinkering. We know he finds it hard to pick. But Ella German, you are made of sterner stuff. You know your 11. Who would you go for?
I do. I think it's bold, but I'm going to go with it. So my 11 would be Karen Bardsley in goal. Lucy Bonds at right back. No doubt about that. Steph Horton, the captain, with Millie Bright in centre defence. Alex Greenwood at right back. Then here's where it gets a bit bold. I would go in a 4-2-3-1 and I would have Jill Scott and Kira Walsh with Frank Kirby playing just in front of them. Beth Mead, Nikita Paris on the wings and Ellen White up front. I think Phil could do that, but who knows? I think it's a little bit dangerous because it's quite an attacking lineup. And with the attacking threat Scotland pose, you could argue it's better to play a 4-3-3 with someone of the likes of Jade Moore in there to break it up. But I can't see a team, an England team, playing at this tournament without Frank Kirby in it. So I'm going to stick to my lineup of a 4-2-3-1.
Let's talk about Kirby. She's discussed frequently as a real threat for Chelsea. How good is she?
On her day, she's fantastic. It just depends whether she decides to turn it on at the World Cup.
How often does she fail to turn up?
So it's a really difficult one this season because it's been really injury hit for her. So it hasn't been the best of seasons when you look at the statistics. But on her day, she's fantastic. I was at King's Meadow in January or February where they beat Reading 4-0 and it was Kirby on her return to injury. And
is that Kirby's former club as well?
Yes, yeah, correct. And yeah, I was really excited. And every time she got the ball, I was on the edge of my seat. She scored 2 goals that night. She was incredible. The problem is it's really hard to tell because she hasn't had a consistent season. I think she had a niggle with her thigh. So it's difficult to know how well she performed this World Cup. But the reason I'd put her in the side is because I know how magical she can be on her day. And I can't see an England team without her. She was nominated for the Ballon d'Or. You've got to put a player like that in the side. And hopefully she can perform. So I'd go with that lineup.
You absolutely have to. Our producers have stopped breakdancing and started doing something useful. I've been informed that Fran Kirby's goal record at Reading before she got that move to Chelsea was 68 goals in 42 appearances. That really is quite hard to argue with. But another potent attacking threat for England is Nikita Paris, who, of course, has impressed for Manchester City to an extraordinary extent, really, 33 in 59 for her. She's got herself a move to that all-star Olympic Lyon side. England have never lost a game in which she has scored. Is she the focal point for Neville's team?
I wouldn't go that far. It's quite hard with the way where he's playing his players. She was out on the wing against New Zealand, and to be honest, she was quite quiet. I think she could be the focal point, but only if England get it right as a team, only if they're cohesive as a team. Obviously, her goal scoring record is incredible. She broke the all-time scoring record in the Women's Super League this season, easily in double figures for the year. And yeah, I think if we're going to talk about who could potentially get the golden boot for England, I would put her up there for sure. Whether she's the focal point of the team, yeah, I'm not sure. It depends on how he decides to line up, and that's the biggest mystery.
Where do you see her best position?
Obviously, for Manchester City, she's played a bit more through the middle, but yeah, I'd probably play her there. Judging on recent performances where she's gone a bit quiet on the wing, I'd probably like to see her there, but again, it's so hard with the depth of our squad because you've got the likes of Ellen White, who I'd equally like to see there. So I'm not sure. I'll probably keep her on the wing. But again, she's excellent down the middle. She was for Man City in the FA Cup final. She really stretched West Ham. So it's just so hard. We've got so much potential going forward.
It's a nice headache to have, though, isn't it? If you're Neville and you're picking your team, how do I get all of my world-class strikers into the team? Exactly. There are worse complaints.
You want a starting 15, but you know, that's not possible.
If only. In terms of less obvious names, not just for England, but throughout the competition as a whole, who could break through onto the world stage in France this summer?
Yeah, it's such an exciting tournament. I've got such a long list. I could probably talk about this for 2 or 3 hours. Seeing as we're talking about England, I'll start off with one of our players, Beth Mead. She's not unknown in the WSL, and I talk about her all the time. I think I'm one of her biggest fans. I've mentioned her earlier, but I think she's absolutely brilliant. She's so quick. She's got a good shot on her. She's only made 13 England appearances, actually. She's never played at a World Cup, but I think this could be her big breakthrough on the international stage. She's got 5 goals in those 13 appearances. I've been lucky enough to see her live a few times, and she is fantastic. So I think this could be a huge summer for her. But going away from England, of course, there are so many other teams who have got those players who could really be making a name for herself. We mentioned Khadija Shaw earlier. She scored more than anyone else in qualifying. I'm hoping she lives up to the hype to excite that group she's in, hopefully cause an upset against the likes of Brazil. That's what we all want. Really looking forward to seeing her. And then we've got a host of young goal scorers, all of whom I think could be really great. We've got Lea Schüller for Germany. She scored a goal every other game for SGS Essen in the Bundesliga this season, and she's got 8 goals in the last 12 games for Germany, so keep an eye on her. We've also got Mallory Pugh for America. Her goal scoring record maybe isn't so great as Schüller's, I've just mentioned, but she's got 16 in her last 53 appearances, which for a 21-year-old forward isn't bad. The question is, will she start ahead of those legendary names? Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Tobin Heath. We don't know, but I'd like to see her.
Is Rapinoe, how is she handling ageing? Is she over the hill yet?
Potentially, yeah. I think this could be the downfall of the US team at this tournament. A lot of their players are in their 30s. As I said, well, Alex Morgan, 29, but she's not the player she quite was. Hasn't got the pace she once had and is more of a deep-lying forward now. The same goes for Rapinoe, same goes for Heath. That said, Rapinoe scored an absolute stunner against us in the She Believes Cup. You know, we managed to draw the game, but I think they've still all got those sparks of quality in them. But not sure whether they've got enough youth in their team to carry them to another title.
Interesting stuff. I just wonder whether Erin Cuthbert could cause England problems. She's been doing very good things for Chelsea. She's going to be fundamental to that Scotland team. How impressive could she be?
You must be psychic because she's the next one on my list. Yes, she is. Yeah, I think alongside Beth Mead, we're seeing two of the breakout stars on Sunday. She's incredible. The scary thing is she's only 20 years old. She turns 21 after the tournament. But in terms of attitude, she's been ready for the big stage for such a long time. I remember when Scotland were still trying to qualify for the World Cup, and when they fell behind to Switzerland, I believe she was the one who at 18 years old was roaring the crowd to get behind them so they could get the points they needed to qualify. And in every game, whether it's for Chelsea or Scotland, she shows that tenacity and those leadership qualities that, you know, make every great player great. Obviously we all know about her in England and in Scotland, but I'm not sure the world know how good she is. She's quick, she's a great goal scorer, scored that absolute screamer against Jamaica last week. So yeah, for sure she's going to be another big name at this tournament.
And if you had to give me a team of dark horses who perhaps aren't being tipped by everyone to be a real threat, but who you think could upset the apple cart, who would you go for?
Scotland.
Really?
Yeah, I mentioned it
earlier.
Throughout the
whole tournament?
I wouldn't back Scotland as a dark horse to win. It's their first World Cup.
You back them as a dark horse to ruin our year.
Yeah, but I really hope they don't. No, I back them as a dark horse. I think, yeah, depending on where they finish, I think they're a team that, you know, aren't really known on the world stage. They're known in England, they're known here, just as I said. But yeah, I think they could upset the odds in Group D more than anyone expected when that draw took place in December. And yeah, they're definitely a team to watch.
Fascinating stuff. I'm going to press you for predictions. I need a score prediction for England versus Scotland. I need a score prediction for France versus South Korea, which is just about to get underway. Let's start there. What are you saying?
I can't wait to get all these wrong. You can ring me up at 10 o'clock tonight. I think France will dominate tonight. I'm going to go 3-0.
3-0. Goal scorers, Le Sommer?
Le Sommer. Maybe Diane on a wing, PSG winger. Maybe Le Sommer 2, one for her.
Lovely. And England versus Scotland, the big one.
1-1.
Oh, come on. 1-1 is not enough. Well, I'm going to go 2-1. I'm going to bring a bit of positivity. And in terms of the toughest prediction of all, the potential winners of the tournament, who would you go for?
Again, I want to say England, but I don't want to be a curse. France.
So we're backing France to batter South Korea, who
they're probably
just about to face. It's very exciting. We're 3.5 minutes away from being underway in the Women's World Cup this summer in Paris. It's been a fantastic Women's World Cup show here on Love Sport Radio. I'm Johnny Burrow. It's been a pleasure to spend an hour in your company. Ella German, we're tipping France for the whole thing, apparently, but I'm tipping England. I'm tipping them against Scotland. I'm tipping them all the way, not because of any statistical insight, but because I just want them to win. And Phil Neville, apparently, is a tactical genius. Who would have thought it?